quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
Hey kids, welcome to Grumpy Nostalgia, the Second Look Cinema Podcast, the show where we go back to the blockbuster new release wall of our memories, grab a copy off the shelf, pop it in the old VCR, and see what time has done to it. But probably more accurately, what time has done to us. I'm Justin, that's Mike.
Hallo und willkommen.
Oh boy, here we go. And we're here to help you navigate all those landmines littered down memory lane. Okay, Mike, so we're doing another show set in the desert, which is very appropriate for the heat that we're currently experiencing, at least where we are. I think the whole world's under a heat wave right now. Might be cooler to do this show in Tunisia, but...
Morocco.
Was it Morocco? Sorry. I see. Yeah, I'm no, already
you're in Star Wars land.
So thanks for coming back, everybody. We are in the second show of our second season. And this episode, we're going to be talking about an interesting little take on Egyptian lore. This is The Mummy, Mike. Not to be confused with the less than successful Tom Cruise, I guess, attempt to reboot the Universal horror franchise. I think that was in 2017. That was pretty much garbage. not to say this thing was much better, but we're going to be looking at the 1999 release, Mike.
Was Boris Karloff still alive for this one?
He would be turning in his grave, get it? What I think was cool about this movie to some degree was it... Well, what I think we can extract from this movie at least is the concept of the remake. This was actually intended to be originally a remake of the, as you mentioned, the Boris Karloff Universal horror classic, The Mummy, which is probably one of the lesser popular Universal horror movies, but really one of the best ones, comparatively speaking. It's really a great movie. And so they decided to remake it. Like, what I think is fun is when Hollywood remakes movies, there's a lot to flush out there. This is one they intended to do a remake on. They always end up calling it a reimagining. And I think they use the term reimagining when the movie sucks.
Yeah.
Planet of the Apes comes to mind.
That's right. Yeah. And the imagining part is a little bit, you know, more emphasized in this version of The Mummy than what you would think of in the original.
I would have imagined a good movie if I was going to remake one. I don't get too hard into this one because there are some things that are a little endearing. And this is a very popular movie still to this day. So let's just get right into it, Mike. As I mentioned, this was released on May 7th, 1999. It was directed by Stephen Sommers, who's really kind of dedicated his directorial career to making these mummy movies and some other Universal horror movies. He did the movie Van Helsing, which kind of
him. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, we probably need to talk about that. We need to have a talk to Steven about that movie as well. But yeah, he kind of stayed in that genre to some degree. It was written by a couple guys, Lloyd Fanville and Kevin Jarre. And Kevin Jarre is, he had done like Rambo and Tombstone. And so he'd had some good ones under his belt. These guys all had screen story credits, not screenplay, Mike. And I know everybody's dying to know what's the difference.
Yeah.
So please file this under things you don't have any real use for. But a screenplay is when you develop original content. And the screen story is when you adapt something that's already kind of existing. So they kind of took a movie and rewrote it. And that's where you get a screen story credit. It had a budget of $80 million. And they spent $20 million of that on special effects. And that was probably the best strategic decision of this movie to spend the money.
The watching the credits on this movie, it was very similar to seeing like the end credits to, you know, like a Star Wars movie or a Marvel movie. It was the number of visual artists that were assigned to this movie. It was crazy.
Yeah. I counted like almost 9 minutes worth of credits and credits for this one. So yeah. So that typically means the story's not that good when you see that. but we'll get to that later. All right. So they had like $60 million left for the production and the cast. So they went a little bargain on the cast at the time, Mike. So why don't you walk us through it, Mike? Who was in this movie?
The cast was a little thin. We have obviously Brendan Fraser, who is our lead Rick O'Connell character, who's kind of the Alan Quartermain version in this movie, where he's a swashbuckling, devil-may-care kind of guy. Brendan Fraser, before this, I never saw him as that kind of character. I always saw him as the goofy kind of 90s guy. You know, you think he wasn't in Biodome, was he? Encino Man, that was the movie. George of the Jungle, Dudley Do-Right, Airheads, some really ridiculous movie called Monkey Bone. I personally liked Bedazzled, which was kind of, it's kind of a guilty pleasure movie for me. If anyone doesn't know, has Elizabeth Hurley many different outfits. And
I'd watch Elizabeth Hurley read the phone book for 2 hours.
Correct. So,
yeah, good one. Yeah.
But Brendan Fraser, like I said, had that kind of goofy, at least to me, goofy comedian, you know, you think kind of a rubber face kind of comedian guy. And I don't know. He was in a couple of good movies. I don't know if it was Gods and Monsters or At Pupil. Yeah,
School Ties.
School Ties. Yeah, he's been in the... Yeah. I'm not going to say high art, but I guess he made an attempt, let's say. And then he's co-starred with someone who probably is the opposite, and Rachel Weisz, who I kind of knew from highbrow kind of English movies and a couple of goofy ones. But I think she won an Academy Award for... You got to correct me because I never looked this up, but Constant Gardner, maybe?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, I just remember Ralph Fiennes. I was like, oh, yeah, that guy. And I think she's Mrs. Daniel Craig now for the last few
years. That is correct. Mike.
And Black Widow. I remember her. She was in the most recent. She was like the mother figure in Black Widow, I think.
Yeah, everybody, every Hollywood actor has to succumb to being in a superhero movie now.
Oh, yeah. Everyone is in a Marvel movie, crazy.
Even Robert Redford. So.
Yes. And really, what was he in? You've already got me.
I think Civil War.
That's right, the Thor. Yeah. He's like a baddie or something that's trying to keep something from Captain America and Thor. Yeah. Okay. All right. Never mind. To round out our good character, John Hannah. He's a Scottish actor. I know. I remember him from Four Weddings and a Funeral. And he was kind of a caddish character in Sliding Doors. In this movie, he's just taking off the mask. And he's just pure goofball in this movie.
He's like the fifth introduction for comic relief that they decided to have here, which they really redundant. I mean, the comedy, let me interrupt you for a second.
No,
Brendan Fraser, I think I came back to, he's relatively charming in this movie. He really carries the movie. And I didn't catch that in my first view, but he's funny enough. And I don't know why we had to have, you know, seven or eight elements of comic relief I think they just left it alone. But anyway, there's plenty more to dissect here. We'll save that. Please keep going.
Well, that's about it. There's your three main people.
Oh, you're done.
And after that, it descends into like, oh yeah, that guy and this guy and that. Oh yeah, that guy from that thing.
Yeah, I noticed they hired just about every English/Egyptian Mediterranean actor that's always been in these kind of roles. They're all here.
They represent, and you know, I think they kind of represent, like you say, every Middle Eastern or Eastern Mediterranean country. They had the rando Americans, of course, who, you know. One of them looked similar to Josh Brolin, but I know it wasn't. Then the bad guy—I don't know if you remember him from the Strain TV show. He's also
he's a
wormy guy in Anaconda, and he's also kind of a wormy guy in Titanic. But in here, I couldn't tell if he was playing an English guy with a fez, or if he was supposed to be Arabic. I know he's an English actor. It's kind of weird.
Egyptologist.
Yes, the rival Egyptologist guy, Burns. Yeah. I think his name was. Mr. Burns. And then you had your kind of, the Arnold Vosloo, who plays Imhotep in this movie. I could not get the image of Billy Zane out of my head because I kept thinking, oh, that's Billy Zane. But it's
doppelganger. Yeah.
It is. It's really weird. But he made a really good, he makes a really good Egyptian. I don't think he's probably from Egypt, but, you know, hey. He played it pretty well.
Hollywood.
Yeah. Obed Fear, which I don't know any other movies he did besides this, but he's
Michael, please. Deuce Bigelow.
I stay away from all Rob Schneider movies.
He was the mentor to Rob Schneider. It's for his gigolo business. I'm sorry. I'll edit that out. Keep going.
And like I do in a lot of these casts, I want to do a special shout out to one of the cast members who has a bit part, but is very important. This is to Bernard Fox. He's more known as Dr. Bombay from Bewitched, and here he plays a boozed up pilot who has a brief moment in this movie and kind of makes it for me. He's a really funny English character in this.
We'll get to him.
Yeah. And I got, indulge me here, Justin. I got a little Should this be my history corner time, or should I wait till you describe the movie a little bit?
Well, why don't you go ahead and throw it in?
Well, okay.
Throw it in now, Mike. We're here.
Yeah, obviously, audience, we don't rehearse this stuff ahead of time. So,
what?
Yeah, shocking. I know this is a fictional movie, but obviously this was one of those things where I'm looking at history. Movies with history, they're like squares. They bug me. There's too many movies that have come out that have... I watch them. I get a little annoyed. I'm going to give you a list here. These are more serious movies that annoy me, like Braveheart, Tombstone, Troy, and the Doors movie. They take moments and they just kind of enhance them, embellish them, add stuff that didn't happen. You know, this is history. Oh, yeah, Star Wars, too. I forgot about that one. But those kind of movies annoy me. And when I'm watching this movie, I'm not looking at I'm entertained, of course, but I hear names that are referenced and thinking, this isn't true. Could it be? And so I put on the Google glasses and actually went online and looked up some of this stuff because there was one name that came out to me. It was Imhotep. And I heard that name. I was like, I know that name. And I remember it from my architecture school. And he designed pyramids way back 3000 BC and about 2800 BC. Justin, I'm going to be a little long winded here. I apologize.
Okay.
He built pyramids and was a famous, probably the world's first famous architect. And he was later, since his pyramids were so mystical and mysterious to the Egyptians that came thousands of years later, they actually deified him as a god, and Imhotep became kind of this, you know, ooh, wow, this guy was incredible. You know, kind of like a tall tale. He became a godlike figure. In this movie, in The Mummy, he becomes a high priest of the Pharaoh, which, okay, I can live with that. But that name it was interesting to me. And he is a high priest of Seti, who was a real character, and he's the Pharaoh at the time. The Seti in real history was not murdered. The Pharaoh, you know, the Pharaoh's priest and his really, really hot mistress.
Wow. Nice, yeah.
Who I don't think was Egyptian either. But then I started thinking, okay, I'm going to go over
I'll let that pass.
There's only two characters in this movie that were real. And that Seti was one of them. And the other one was our female protagonist, played by Rachel Weisz. There actually was a Evelyn. And I thought this was probably the most clever thing this movie did was there was an Evelyn Carnarvon, who was, you know, one of the ladies. I think she was the daughter of Lord Carnarvon, who helped fund the finding of King Tut. And she was an actual god bless real person. And she actually went by the name Evie. And I thought that was kind of neat that there was a character that she was one of the first people to actually see Tut's tomb in real history. Wow. Yeah, I thought so too. Can I give away a couple spoilers real quick?
Well, we're 23 years past, so I think, we're safe.
Awesome. All right. There was a actual on Google is Wikipedia. This is, you know, I watch movies like Idiocracy and realize how our culture kind of devolves. And you look up some of this Egyptian stuff online, and it actually becomes melded into lore from the Mummy series. This is honest to God truth. It is hard to find real Egyptian history unless you do kind of a deep dive, because there's so much on there about the Mummy. And you start reading it like, oh yeah, Seti was murdered by his high priest. It's like, no, no. And then they have they mentioned the Book of Amun-Ra, which is in this movie later on. And there's no such, the Egyptians never had books. There was a Book of the Dead, but it's not an actual book. It was papyrus. That's all fantasy. So there's no actual city of the dead. There's places where they, you know, embalm people and such, not, you know, but there was no mystical city of the dead, which, I mean, that would make sense, right? And that was kind of the background I got, and everything else was fantasy. I did like I said the mention of Evelyn Carnarvon and the bringing in of the time was actually correct. 1927 was a hotbed for people to, you know, study Egyptology because King Tut's tomb had been discovered a couple of years earlier. So the time was right. Egyptian history is kind of thrown out the window. Sorry, I was way over. Please, this will be edited later. Thank you, Justin.
Well, I just want to say that, you know, we can continue to bring this programming here at PBS with the support from viewers like you.
Thank you.
So what interesting thing that you mentioned there is the dumbing down of America. Whenever I do research for these things, the Google autofill inevitably fills out, was The Mummy based on a true story, or was Congo based on a true story? Was Jurassic Park real? So someone's typing in those requests. So
But there was just so much, like, when you actually look up Book of the Dead, I mean, you get shown the book from the movie and not the papyrus original scrolls that show you how to embalm a body. It's like, wait, no, they're two different things. And it's just funny how, like I said, I shuddered a bit when I saw there was something called Wikipedia.
Well, what's
instead, instead of Wikipedia, it was based on Rick O'Connell's, you know, adventures. Ugh.
Well, speaking of which, let's get into it, Mike. We're going to talk about the Mummy. So we're talking about 1999. As you recall, there's a few things going on in 1999, Mike. The biggest one was PayPal had launched, and everybody said PayPal would be a terrible idea. Wouldn't work. We were in the throes of the Y2K fear fest. The fear mongering had really started on the Y2K phenomenon. DVDs had started to make their way into the market. The nation was getting all his music through Napster. And we had spent about a month removed from The Matrix coming out when we all convinced ourselves we thought that was still good. And then I think $9.50 was the new ticket price. They raised ticket prices in New York. I think there was actually a political action to kind of control that. They thought they were gouging the middle class. So that worked, of course. You know, they fixed inflation. So now we're fine. A couple of notes about your cast. We talked about Brendan Fraser. Sylvester Stallone was considered for the role. He was the first choice there, believe that or not. Yeah. Could have been an entirely different movie. I think they decided to go more of a Indiana Jones route with this one. And I don't think Stallone even back then was could have pulled that off quite accurately. I mentioned Stephen Sommers as the director. This was originally given to Clive Barker and George Romero. They're going to kind of collaborate on it. And I think the end result would have been significantly different had those two actually had a chance to do it.
Yeah.
But they didn't, the studio did not like the dark tone they chose with it, you know, and then apparently the concept of bringing somebody back from the dead and haunting, they felt that was too dark for some reason. I don't know. So they handed it off to Joe Dante and John Sayles, where they had actually had signed Daniel Day-Lewis to play the mummy here.
Oh, wow.
But they only wanted to give him $15 million to do the movie. So obviously got canned. And what we got was this. So we always talk about the first time we saw these films. Mike, how about you go first this time? What was the first time you saw this?
I never did. This was the first time I saw it was last night. I was
busted.
Yeah. I was, it was a little mix of Brendan Fraser and historical movie kind of, you know, paranoia. Yeah. I did not want to see any movie with Brendan Fraser. I, for some reason, was just really annoyed by the movies he had done before this one. Obviously, Bedazzled came out after this, so my opinion changed a little bit. But I don't know why I like that movie. But anyway, I want to apologize because it was my suggestion for this movie. And But one of the first movies Justin and I saw together in theater was The Mummy 2. And kind of went on his suggestion at that time. So it was his fault when I saw that movie. So I blame him.
Hey, okay. All right.
But so.
Own up.
But
own up.
It's one of the. I think it's the only time I've ever seen a sequel before I saw the original. And the sequel wasn't very good. So I was like, well, that's not a surprise. We've had this conversation before. Sequels aren't usually as good as the original. So you think, okay, wow, the original's going to be good. So I went into this thinking, yeah, this is going to be pretty epic. You know, this is Indiana Jones light, maybe. So
right.
I was this was my first viewing. So how about you?
Okay. Well, I, as you recall, this was in the throes of the Phantom Menace hype. Everybody was just completely insane about waiting for that movie to come out. And this movie came out a couple weeks early. So it was kind of everybody's kind of pressure relief valve. Well, let's go see something. This looks cool. There's, you know, that really kind of drove me to the theater just to get in the mood, kind of like getting in the batter circle, the on deck circle, you know, before you step up to the plate. And I sat down and I took my poor wife to this and we saw it at a theater that's sadly no longer there, right outside the Galleria Mall here in where we live, and lovingly referred to as the Gonorrhea Mall by the locals. And if you were ever there, you ever visited the mall, you'd know why. But it is a great place if you're looking for a wig. There's several stores that supply wigs now, Mike. but sadly, the decline of the American Mall is really kind of interesting, and we'll have to talk about that in some capacity later. But especially as it results to the movie theater, you know, a lot of the malls, most of the movies I saw as a teenager were the result of them being anchored at the mall. You know, you'd hang out all day shopping with your friends, and then you go to the food court, and then you'd you'd go to the theater that was attached to the mall. And when those malls kind of shuttered up, you know, the theaters went with them. So I think that's had a big effect on the movie going public, but we'll get to that. So anyway, I saw this movie at a theater that, you know, no longer exists, of course, and about 20 minutes into the movie, the film broke.
It was a mummy's curse.
Exactly. Well, I'm kind of a film snob, and I could never kind of get myself back into it after that. I just got annoyed. I don't know if it was necessarily the movie's fault, but it just wasn't a very pleasant experience. Interesting, Mike, you mentioned the curse. This movie, when it premiered in Hollywood for the first opening night, the film broke.
So
the same thing happened there. So of course, you know, mummy's curse, blah blah blah. But I spent a lot of years just not having a good association with this movie, so I thought we'd revisit this movie, you know, 23 years later as smart adults, and give it a look. So that's what we're gonna do now. So Mike, I think we should probably get to it at some point. The mummy.
Yeah, we've done enough preamble.
Yeah, a sarcophagus for the rest of us. There you go, dad joke. All right, so Mike, if you're ready, hit the button. So the movie kind of opens up with a, you know, 7-minute prologue kind of going through the Imhotep backstory. And to summarize it, because Mike already has, in real life, there's kind of essentially a love triangle. Imhotep is a priest, and the high priestess gets killed. They're having an affair with his wife, which is the Akasunatun, I think she's referred to. Yeah, so I practiced that a few times. But she, rather than spend her life with this priest, prophet rather, she commits harikari, and not the Cubs announcer, but the act of killing yourself. And Imhotep vows to resurrect her, and that's the premise for the movie. And before he does that, he gets captured by the high priest's minions, and they kind of kill him off, and they actually mummify him. And he goes,
yes, which apparently, according to Wikipedia, was a real thing, but it's not.
Yeah, so the Humdai is, he essentially gets buried alive. He gets mummified, and they throw all these scarab beetles in the coffin with him, and he's supposed to suffer for all eternity. Kind of like the Sublime Ateme, Mike, from a movie we love.
Thank you, Neil Connery.
So they decide to, rather than just kill him and be done with him, they decide to put him in a hole, hope that he never gets resurrected, because he would bring upon the end of mankind. So there's your premise for the movie. And guess what? He gets dug up. So that leads us to... we jump there's a little bit of a time jump here, Mike, to 1923, Hymenoptera, as we talked about. We get introduced to suave and debonair Brendan Fraser playing Rick O'Donnell, and he's a member of the French Foreign Legion. The opening scene is him. There's a standoff between the French soldiers and these hoarding marauders on horseback. It's kind of like a big battle scene there. And I like what they call it. Ululating, Mike? The la 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 la.
Ululating, yeah.
They sounded like a thundering herd of Curly Howards coming out. But I think in Arabic culture, that is only designated for the females. I think men are allowed to do that. But anyway, he's standing there, standing off here, Brendan Fraser, with his guns, and he's leading the force, and he's shadowed by this little character called Benny, who's kind of a combination of Igor and Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. You can just tell he's up to no good. But they have this big battle scene. Everybody kind of gets wiped out. Brendan Fraser starts running away, and as he does, he kind of comes up to this tombstone, or the Anubis, where they had buried Imhotep. And of course, all the bad guys run away, and he thinks, you know, as all this is happening, this group of protectors called the Magi are looking on to make sure that the
I gotta stop you right there.
Yeah,
they're not the Magi. They're the Magi. So
Magi.
I thought that was very interesting. They didn't want to call them the Magi, but the Magi. Oh. So a group, apparently apparently the Magi are as inept at guarding a tomb as the monks in Fifth Element. I don't know.
Fifth Element.
All these. Yeah. You had one job to do. Yeah. You had one job to do. You're guarding a tomb for thousands of years so that nobody else can discover it. And there's like hundreds of these Magi Bedouin uvulating like soldiers, and they cannot stop apparently the finding of this mystical city.
Well, it's just a continuation of all the stuff they lifted from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Yeah, I mean,
they had the same kind of element, kind of guarding the Holy Grail to the same effect. So we do a little time after that battle's done. We do another time jump 3 years later, and we get introduced to Rachel Weisz, who's playing Evie. She's kind of this cute little librarian, Egyptologist, and for some reason they decide to introduce her through this weird like Home Alone first scene where she gets stuck on a ladder and then everything knocks over all the bookcases and we also get introduced to her brother John, who's played by John Hannah.
Yeah.
Was that his name, John? Anyway, they do a quick little jump scare. The takeaway here is that he's pickpocketed this key to the tomb of Imhotep from Rick, and then Rick got put into prison. And stay with me, because I only have one page of summary here, because there's not a whole lot happening. So they decide they want to go to this jail and see if they can rescue or get Brendan Fraser out, and this creepy little warden says no, and we're witness to a public hanging, Mike, which I thought was cute.
Oh, I know, wasn't that beautiful?
So he falls a good 12 feet, and his neck doesn't break.
You know, he didn't even have the scars on his neck later, kind of like Clint Eastwood hang him high. You know, he actually like had marks on his neck. But you know, I'm gonna relax. I gotta stop. I'm being over.
Yes,
I'm,
right.
I'm being really insufferable right now. I apologize, audience.
We'll be here all day. Even a chiropractor is not even needed. Not one vertebrae out of place. But through some heavy, ham-fisted exposition, they decided they want to group up and go to Hamunaptra. Is it Hamunaptra? Hamunaptra?
Hamunaptra.
The city. Yes. Hamunaptra.
The city of the dead.
Yeah, so they want to go to the city of the dead and get all the gold. And then, she wants to go there for the intellectual part of it. They get on this boat, and they meet a bunch of Americans on there, Mike, and we know they're Americans because they drink and they're dumb.
They play poker and they shoot guns.
Yeah, woohoo. Well, they're not that far off. So the Magi get on the boat, and then they make a mess and tear up the place and set the boat on fire just to keep them from going.
You know, the Magi again seem to be they're like a bottomless can of peanuts at Texas Roadhouse. Like, there's so many of them. They just keep coming and coming, and they're very disposable. I'm amazed at how quickly their numbers get thinned, but they always seem to have enough to show up somewhere.
Right. So they end up at the city, and there's like two groups of them that are trying to get there and find the treasure. And they come across the Book of the Dead, which kind of looks like the Necronomicon, Mike, I think, from
very familiar.
And despite all the warnings, they both misinterpret all the warnings. And of course, she reads from the book and activates the mummy. So he comes up, and he's obviously in his mummy form, kind of sticky skeleton. And he kind of
juicy.
He's juicy, they refer to him. Yeah. So he spends the first part of his resurrection trying to take body parts off the random cast. So he takes the guy's eyes and his tongue. And what I thought was an odd choice here is that they spent the majority of the movie trying to make the monster less scary as the movie progresses. He starts out as just,
Yeah, he's you're right. Like when the cat scares him, which is a nice touch. You know, there was a fear of cats in Egypt, but also a reverence of cats. I don't quite get that. But his powers in this movie are very variable. Based on the situation, but I'm a little. There's some things he can't do. There's some things he can do. You're kind of scratching your head. Okay, yeah.
So he starts stealing body parts, and then, you know, to the horror of everybody, he becomes more handsome and charming. he's turning into a GQ model.
He Billy Zanes himself.
Yeah. So he Billy Zanes up. And his motivation here is he wants to bring his longtime love, Anka Suntun, back to life, and he misinterprets Evie as that entity. So he uses her as a sacrifice, and so there's a series of, you know, random adventure tropes that we go into. For some reason, the Cairo warden joins the group to protect his investment. I guess they paid him off to get Brendan Fraser freed. And they make several jokes about his hygiene, which is funny. He wanders off and starts finding these what he thinks are jewels, but they're actually the shells of these beetles. And so he gets kind of eaten up. The Americans, because they're Americans and dumb, they kind of get picked off one by one. The Egyptologist gets picked off one by one by the mummy and his minions. He brings these mummies to life out of the wall. And what I thought was funny here, Mike, was that, you know, the CGI was incredibly impressive. But for all the other mummies, they're just people in suits.
Yeah.
they're just guys in like Halloween costumes.
Right. The effects though, where they get cut apart and their arms can still move. Yeah. That was pretty clever.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to nitpick there, but
I'll do that.
Yeah. So the end scene kind of culminates with Evie's on this sacrificial table. And what I thought was weird, Mike, is this is supposed to be the big ending, but it's like they're reading math problems. Like that's how they solve it. She's reading to them what to do. Read the book, read that chapter. I mean, it took the suspense out.
It did. When she's like telling them what the Bembridge scholars would have done, or reading out, you know, oh yeah, no, that stork bird, that's really means this, read that, read a couple of words and he'll disappear, or, you know, it's like,
what? Right.
Really?
And meanwhile, they're fighting off all these Imhotep slaves that he's resurrected, and they're just kind of people that have silly putty on their face, if you look very closely. But the good team, they all kind of just take turns dying to we're down to the end there. And we had this weird scene where I think Winston Harlock, Mike, you mentioned the guy played by Ray.
Dr. Bombay.
Yeah, Dr. Bombay. He plays this like leftover English British pilot. We know he's English, Mike, because he says old chap a lot.
And of course, his name Winston.
Yeah. But he wanted to be, you know, he wanted to die a glorious death as a pilot. So he gets his chance and takes the remaining survivors of the crew on this plane crash. And they crash pretty violently and he dies, but everybody else survives, even though they were like literally tied to the wings of the plane.
Sand effect was neat with the Imhotep kind of creating a wave of sand with his face in it. That was really cool. I thought that was probably...
Yeah.
The most memorable part of the movie, and you're like, wow, this guy, he's super powerful. He could do that. And then once he's inside the tomb, he can't even like pick up a book out of a guy's hand. You know, it's like, oh, what happened?
Horrified, scared to death of Toots is the cat. So the end scene kind of is them in this burial chamber kind of fighting it out. And as I mentioned, after this long exposition filled solution to the problem, they read the spell, and this crazy weird ghost riding a horse driven carriage drives through and steals Imhotep's soul out of him, making him immortal. And then in the meantime, Brendan Fraser finds a gold sword that he starts swinging around like a Louisville slugger, and stabs and kills Imhotep, and the curse is over. So the movie kind of ends with the sweeping music, and he kisses Rachel Weisz, and they ride off into the sunset, and we see the gold sword kind of twinkling like Joe Pesci's tooth.
Oh
yeah. And the movie's over. Forgive us, team. That was a very rough shot view of the summary of the film, but anybody has seen this knows that we didn't miss much.
No.
So the movie ends, and let's talk about the aftermath. So, Mike, this was a big hit, of course. I think, as we mentioned, there was it co-opted a lot of the anticipation for the summer movie season developed by Star Wars. But it made $44 million in its opening weekend, which in 1999 is a good haul. It ended up making $155 million in the U.S. domestically, and $450 million worldwide. So this was a big one. It did manage to get a few Oscar nominations, believe it or not, for Best Sound, for sure. Did not win. It ran the gamut at the Blockbuster Awards, got 4 nominations for all the major cast members. Even MTV took note of it, Mike, our beloved MTV. was up against best action sequence, Mike. And as you recall from our last movie, I think it was for the plane scene in the the sandstorm. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
But sadly, it lost out to the pod race scene.
Star Wars. Phantom
Menace. Yeah. Yeah.
Spinning, that'll do the trick.
But I think what's more important about the legacy of this movie is the amount of sequels it churned out. So we had the Mummy Returns, not the Mummy 2, the Mummy Returns.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's the one that we decided to go see and really changed our lives. I remember looking at each other during this thinking, wow, what have I done to this new friend of mine?
Yeah, that was a disappointment.
And then they kind of splintered off into the Scorpion King, Mike. The Scorpion King was a character developed in The Mummy Returns. We got our chance to see Rocky Maivia in his first films, or as I always know him as Flex Cavana, Mike. Of course, we're talking about The Rock, kids. It's Dwayne Johnson. So he did The Scorpion King and then the Scorpion King 2. And I was surprised to know that there is a Scorpion King 3, 4, and 5, Mike. There are five Scorpion King movies out. Wow. Each one gets a little more, like if you clone a clone of a clone of a clone, they get a little more retarded on the evolutionary scale. For example, the... Episode 3, Scorpion King 3 stars your aforementioned Billy Zane, Mike.
No way.
And Ron and Ron Perlman.
Of course.
So it kind of degrades a little bit more there genetically. So it's Scorpion King 4, you had Barry Bostwick and Lou Ferrigno, Mike. I think Scorpion King 5 just had some people at the bus station. But there's a lot of movies that came out as a result of this.
it degrades faster than like uranium. that is sad.
A good half-life there.
I thought there was I guess they branched off. Like I thought the Mummy sequels kind of went. I thought there was one that involved like China, going to China or something, or like
That was the Tomb of the Dragon Emperor was the one you're talking about, Mike.
Oh, okay.
And that's that was in 2000.
Is that Mummy canon? Is that part of the?
You know what? I'll have to get back on that one. I kind of checked out of the Mummy franchise after the Scorpion King.
Yeah,
This was like 2008. Now, what I do remember about that movie is the CGI looking significantly less good. So let's do our diligence, Mike. The Grumpy Meter, you should be quick because you don't have a reference point. You just want to tell me your overall thoughts of the movie.
I mean, like I said, it was a kind of a mix of disappointment and overall kind of just since the sequel was so bad, I figured this movie had some more meat on its bones. But it sounds more like people that went to see. This is going to be a really weird analogy. So apologize. It sounds like people who went to see Captain Marvel before they saw Avengers Endgame, you know, like, oh, like you kind of referenced how this movie came up before the Star Wars movie. It was kind of a appetizer or aperitif, if you will, that came out and people almost felt like they had to see this movie before they saw the big one. And maybe that's why it made so much money. This is all negative. I really feel like I've been grumpy about this, and there is no nostalgia, but it had its charm. It was a kind of, at times a fun flick, and it had even the cuts between scenes were like done a la George Lucas. I don't know if you noticed how some of the scenes kind of went up and sigh. It reminded me a little bit of that Star Wars touch.
The screen wipe. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And
love that.
I like that. And I did like it was a competently written plot. It did make sense as far as in its own universe, in the Rick universe. But it was in its own way kind of fun. But there is no way I could watch this without having to be forced to. So,
all right,
I would say 1.5 to 2 stars. It's better than what comes out nowadays, but that's kind of a low bar.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna kind of piggyback on that thought, So the first time I saw it, my frustration with the theater, breaking the film and getting the sound not synced up, I really never got out of that, which was unfair to it. So I kind of watched it the second time, and I don't think it's a great movie. But again, I did pull out some things that I didn't expect. I don't think I'd intentionally watch it again. But what I did notice this time was, like you said, compared to today's movies, it's right on par. The special effects were great. I oddly enough, I thought Brendan Fraser was the best part of this movie.
Yeah, I did think that he was better than what I'd seen him in before, you know, with the exception of Bedazzled. He had his charm, and like I said, as the movie went on, the first 15, 20 minutes, this guy's a lout, you know, I don't want to be around him. But as it goes along, and as interaction with Rachel Weisz, it kind of worked. And I did see him as that character. And when you mentioned, you know, Sylvester Stallone no, thank you. I would like to have seen maybe like a Tom Cruise or Harrison Ford kind of character, but Brendan Fraser worked for the comic, you know, elements of this movie.
Yeah, he had like an old 40s Hollywood charisma charm to him that I think suits the role very well. He's a badass, but he's kind of goofy at the same time, and he was just kind of really drove the movie and kept me in it. All the other characters, I'm not quite sure I had that kind of support for, but he did carry it, and the special effects were good. And you know, I think movies like this now, I think I've just missed the boat. I think that ship has sailed for me. I think people can still like this movie. People still do love this movie. If you look at trends and stuff, this movie trends very well on IMDb, and there's a lot more interest in it now. And it's a bit of a renaissance. People, you know, like this movie, and I understand why. But I kept thinking about this is a Saturday morning cartoon, that I'm above that, but it's just
it's a movie that tried to bring like the goofiness of The Mummy meets Abbott and Costello, but then it has horror elements of, like you say, George Romero, or and even the it's one thing to do kind of a goofy takeoff of movies from the 40s and the 50s. But when you dress it up with the visuals and the scariness of this movie, it doesn't quite work for me, at least, you know?
Yeah. Good effort. Good attempt. I mean, I'm not going to tear it down. It's just not for me. I would go back. I think that first one, I would give a 2 out of 5 just based on my biased opinion on the environment I saw it in. But going back at it, I probably 2.5 tops. I mean, it's one of those things where if it's on in the background, I'll probably just leave it on, because visually it looks great, and you know, there's some good performances, and but again, it's kid stuff, and you know, I only have in my hard drive, I've already filled up all the guilty pleasure kid stuff. I've already got that. You know, if I fill it up more, I may take a different path, and I got to keep that boundary in place. But yeah, it's just I appreciate the charm of it for sure, but you know, give me something else. So so let's cleanse the palate a little bit, Mike. So this is the time of the show where we kind of talk about things we may be watching when we're not watching retro movies. For me, I've kind of stumbled upon a really kind of cool series on Apple Plus called Blackbird, and it's kind of based on a true story about from one of my old stomping grounds, Kankakee, Illinois, a gun runner that got put in prison, and he gets coerced by the FBI to befriend a serial killer that's currently in the same prison to extract some information on where he's buried the bodies. But there's really strong performances. Yeah. But I forget his name, but the actor that plays Elton John is just tremendous in this role. And it's really a shame that I can't remember his name, but he's just a standout performer here. So it's a great show. I just kind of stumbled upon it. I just didn't really know anything about it. And, you know, what are we going to watch next? That's the most commonly phrase in our house anymore. And this came up, and we really enjoyed it. So it's Blackbird on Apple Plus. Mike, what are you watching?
I'll tell you what I watched right after I watched this movie. For some reason, the movie, it was so forgettable. I was trying to cleanse my palate of The Mummy. So I watched Left Behind with Nicolas Cage from 2014. And
sadist.
I know it was kind of a riff on the Left Behind series. I'm not a Christian, but it was a interesting movie. I was like I said, it was a palate cleanser. It was totally different from The Mummy.
Different afterlife scenario. Yeah.
Yes, it was. It was a little heavy-handed for my likings, but Nicolas Cage makes the movies. It's kind of like a, I don't know if you remember Robbie Benson and what was the Mystery Science Theater movie where he's just in an office.
City Limits.
Yes.
City Limits.
City yeah. Limits. It was the same, but Nicolas Cage spends, you know, 90% of the movie in his cockpit just flying a plane, you know, with a green screen behind him. But boy, if he wasn't in that movie, it would have been dismal. But now I want to watch Bedazzled, another palate cleanser. If you really want to see Brendan Fraser as he should be best remembered, you should watch this movie. He is tricked by the devil, who is played by Elizabeth Hurley in this movie, and trying to win his girl. And he appears as various characters throughout the movie that he tries to win the affection of his girl. Yeah. And it's goofy. It's stupid, and I love it. I recommend
it. Well, along those lines, let me piggyback on that. I would recommend another Brendan Fraser movie, Encino Man. I'll tell you why. I mean, I was working in movie theater when this came out in 1992, and people love this movie. It stars him as a caveman that gets frozen out in the San Fernando Valley by Sean Astin and Pauly Shore.
Yes.
Stay with me. But it kind of really focuses his charm. And even as a caveman that can't speak English at all and learns it, it's a very silly PG family friendly movie, but you can tell right away that he's got a presence on screen that's charming, and he's got a lot of charisma, and it's just a funny little story. And just to see Sean Astin clutching his pearls in every scene, you'll love that, Mike. But Encino Man, give it a whirl.
He kind of reprised that role in it was a movie where he's like in a bunker, like from the 50s, and preparing for nuclear war. And then
Alicia Silverstone. Yeah,
and he comes out as a grown man and sees I guess it's set in the 80s, but it's kind of that same, like, here's a fish out of the water kind of premise. And he plays like this straight arrow 50s guy that has to learn like today's.
Right.
It's pretty funny. I forgot what it was called, but it was very similar to Encino Man as far as, you know, being this character that's out of his element, but goofy. You know, so he's good at
that. We are swimming in the deep end of the 90s pool right now, Mike. We gotta throw ourselves a life preserver and get out. So that's probably good enough for us today, Mike. Just want to remind everybody that we're still taking submissions for guests. If you'd like to join our show and do some top five lists with us, if you're interested in doing that, you can reach out to us at nostalgiagrumps@gmail.com. If you're interested in any kind of show notes or what's coming up or show trailers, or you'd like to engage us in one way or the other, you can always check out our Instagram page. That's @grumpynostalgia. For all of our moms and aunts, we're going to be looking at starting a Facebook group here shortly. So keep an eye out on that. We'll let everybody know when that gets started. I want to thank all the people on LinkedIn that have joined the show. I did not expect the kind of explosion in our listener base as a result of broadcasting on a business network social media site. But for those of you that may have found our show through my LinkedIn page, we want to really thank everybody for joining us and hope you stick with us. And I'm going to try to cater every show to a business aspect so I can post every show on LinkedIn.
There's a lot. Obviously, there's a lot of work going on out there. You know,
that's someone's working, not us. But but listen to this at work. So that's gonna kind of wrap it up here, Mike. And again, remember, you can listen anywhere. Just remember, you can check out our show on any of the major podcasting hosting services. We're featured on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora. We are on all. So just check us out wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to have you. So, Mike, anything else before we leave here?
Mark this down. We need to do a top five movies that distort history in some way. I would love to be part of that. But for right now, I'm going to get on Wikipedia and see if camels can outrun horses.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Let me know how that turns out. So I can't dig up anymore, Mike. Get it? Found the mummy.
I have a bone to pick with you.
That's a wrap. All right. We apologize. We won't be this bad ever. We'll try to do better the next time, guys. So for Mike James, this is Justin, and we will see you again next time.